This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Why is the number of incarcerated women in North Carolina growing faster than the number of incarcerated men? Data show that from 2009 to 2015, the number of women in state prisons grew 19%, and in that same period, the number of men in our state prisons grew only 1%. This trend matches what is happening nationally, and today we're digging into this gender gap and taking a closer look at the needs of incarcerated women. And we're starting with something called the adultification bias against African-American girls. It is a perception that black girls are more adult-like and less innocent than their white counterparts. National statistics show that black girls are suspended more than five times as often as white girls, and almost three times more likely to be referred to the juvenile justice system. Rebecca Epstein looked at the racial gap in discipline, and she's the executive director of Georgetown Law Center on Poverty and Inequality, and she joins me now. Rebecca, welcome to the State of Things.
Thanks for having me.
Tell me more about the adultification bias. What is it?
Well, as you have said, adultification bias is a way of describing adults' attitudes toward black girls and seeing them as less innocent than white girls of the same age. And our first study back in 2017 showed that adults indicate this bias as early as the age of 5 years old in black girls. So that translates into a scenario in which a kindergarten teacher could potentially be wielding this bias against a black girl in her class and holding her to a more adult-like standard of behavior than her white peers.
Well, tell us more about this report. It was called Girlhood Interrupted, the Erasure of Black Girls' Childhood. As you say, 2017. How did you conduct the report? How did you find out that these biases exist?
We gave a questionnaire to adults. We, of course, didn't tell them what it was that we were measuring, but our questions were directed at measuring perceptions of innocence. And we asked them about their perceptions of black girls and separately about white girls. And we divided it into four age groups. And the age group that showed the greatest discrepancy in perceptions of innocence were the ages of 10 to 14, which surprised us. And what surprised us even more was that the second highest discrepancy was in the age group of 5 to 9 years old. Mm. We had expected the biggest discrepancy to come in high school when kids are starting to actually look and act more like grown-ups. But in fact, this perception is affecting black girls at very young ages. In fact, at ages that really epitomize innocence.
What kind of questions did you ask?
We asked very overt questions. We really didn't hide the ball. We asked, do black girls need protection? Do black girls need nurturing? Do black girls know about adult topics? And so these were questions that were aimed at measuring, again, these perceptions of black girls as children. The reason that we have a juvenile justice system in this country that's different from the adult criminal justice system is that we as a society have reached a consensus that children are different than adults. They should be given leniency. They're not mature. They don't know how to assess risk. They're more vulnerable to peer influences. And yet, if you look at a girl and you see her as an adult, you're more likely to treat her as one and treat her more harshly. So that's why we think this is one factor that might go into the disproportionately punitive treatment that black girls receive.
And tell us about the discrepancies that you found. Again, you broke it into age groups, right? So 0 to 4, 5 to 9, 10 to 14, 15 to 19. Each age group, you ask these questions. Do they need protection? Do they need nurturing? Do they know about adult topics? Do they know about sex? So tell us about the discrepancies you found when you asked those questions.
Well, the greatest discrepancy was in the ages of 10 to 14. We didn't really break it down much further than that, but and then the second biggest age group with showing the discrepancy was 5 to 9. But what we felt was important to do as well is to go directly to black women and girls and ask them if these results aligned with their life experience. And almost to a person, those women and girls said yes. So our latest study, which was launched last week, told their stories and their perspectives.
Tell us more about that. That's the, as you say, this follow-up study where you talk to black girls and young women themselves, women themselves, to see if this matched what you, the discrepancy actually matched their experience. Give us a sense now, a detailed sense of what you found.
Okay. Our youngest participant in these focus groups across the country was 12 years old, and the oldest age group was over 60 years of age. And across generations, there was a consistent response that black girls routinely experience this kind of adultification bias. And it took the form of police officers not believing them when they said, I'm too young to have a driver's license, so I can't produce the ID you're looking for. Those girls said they were handcuffed and taken down to the station, even though they were 15 or 13. Some girls went to see the school nurse at the age of 12, and their adult caretaker was asked if they were sexually active, even though that was so very far from the case in sixth grade. Others said that teachers were much more likely to perceive them as threatening and sent them to the principal's office or even referred them to police officers, where white girls are less likely to be perceived as threatening and disrespectful and disobedient.
So you've got these two reports, one that takes a look at the discrepancy that you find in terms of how adults perceive black girls compared to how they perceive white girls. Then you have their own subjective experience. And if anybody wonders, well, how does that translate into perhaps contact with the criminal justice system or unfair treatment down the line? I think then you point back to a research study that was done on black boys and the perception and the impact that that has had, right?
That's right. And I wasn't involved in that study, so I can't speak too much to the details of it. But in 2014, Dr. Philip Goff and his team of researchers looked at a similar set of issues for black boys. It was a very in-depth study, a very robust study, and they found that the respondents who viewed black boys as older also were more likely to view them as guilty of crimes. So he has sort of helped us with that link between viewing a child as an adult and punishing them as a criminal, and that that bias goes toward both things. You view them as older, you view them as more likely to be engaged in criminal behavior, and you're more likely to punish them like an adult as a result.
And as you say, our criminal justice system has often and clearly recognized a difference, and yet the biases suggest that we don't in our perception, although the legal system does, you know, legally and in terms of court rulings. So what about policy changes? What's your sense of what should happen now that we have all this evidence?
Well, that's a great question, and turning to solutions is very important. So we've done this first piece. We think elevating awareness of how widespread the problem is hopefully can inspire some policymakers to make change. We're hoping to develop training that might help teachers overcome this bias, police officers to overcome this form of bias. That's one way that we can address the issue directly. I think there are lots of other policy implications as well. And one might be collecting more data that's broken down by race and by age so that we can look at patterns that might be clear when you do gather this data, showing that there might be a pattern of discrimination against black girls or black boys in schools in terms of who is disciplined and for what, and who's referred out to the juvenile justice system and for what. So data collection and acting on the patterns that we find from analyzing that data is one important step.
With that kind of data collection, it seems to me you talked about training, and I'm going to ask you in a second, you know, how those would develop, what would that look like, and if there are any models out there. But it seems to me essential to that might be the data within your school or within your police department, first to demonstrate to those who might be incredulous that this is happening here, and then second, the training, and what would that look like?
That's right. It's two different tracks. Data collection is one piece that can really surface some of the problematic discriminatory patterns that might be out there. But training really is hard to argue against. And there are trainings that are available on being more trauma-informed so that you don't misinterpret behavior that you just label as acting out and give a citation for, but instead learn how to approach kids who've experienced trauma And there's also cultural competency training so that teachers who may not have had cross-population experience can start to understand the kids that they work with better. And another piece of the puzzle, especially for teachers and police officers, I think, is to think about brain development, because a seven-year-old's brain is a seven-year-old's brain, regardless of the color of their skin. And all of our brains develop along similar tracks. And we can't hold a seven-year-old's brain to a 35-year-old's brain standard of what we expect.
What's next for your research?
Well, we're hoping to do a deeper dive and to conduct research into teachers themselves and some of their perceptions.
Rebecca Epstein is the executive director of the Georgetown Law Center on Poverty and Inequality, and you can find links to her research at our website, stateofthings.org. Rebecca Epstein, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Just ahead, we're going to talk about how women are treated in the juvenile justice system here in North Carolina on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Please stay with us. This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. The number of incarcerated women in North Carolina is growing faster than the number of men in prison, and it's a trend that mirrors what's happening at the national level as well. Recent prison reforms have reduced the total number of those in state prisons over the last decade, but almost all of that progress has been among men. We're talking about this gender gap today and looking at the different facets of the criminal justice system here in North Carolina. Latest data shows girls make up 23% of the juvenile justice referrals in North Carolina. So what happens once those girls are in the system? William Lassiter is Deputy Secretary of Juvenile Justice at the North Carolina Department of Public Safety, and he joins me now. William Lassiter, welcome.
Thank you.
What happens once a girl is referred to the juvenile justice system in our state?
So in our state, we have a unique system where we have juvenile court counselors that are hired by the department to do the intake of those juveniles when they come into the system. So a law enforcement officer may arrest a juvenile and file a petition on them, and then the juvenile court counselor would meet with the child and their family and to determine what are the best services for this child moving forward. And that's done through a risk and needs assessment that's done of that juvenile when they walk in the door. And then we make a determination whether or not we can dismiss that case, divert that case from court, or if we need to approve it to go to court. And the unique facet in North Carolina is that our juvenile court counselors really have the power to make that decision on whether to divert cases or to approve them to go to court. So in 40% of all cases that come to our attention in the juvenile justice system, our juvenile court counselors do a diversion plan or contract with that juvenile. And what that is that they do that risk and needs assessment, and they will refer them to a service provider in the local community. And if they commit to doing all the services that are on that contract, then that case never goes to court. And the cases that where we believe that the court does need to get involved, those would be approved to go to court, and then a judge would be involved in the decision-making about what happens with that juvenile next.
In the juvenile system, does an individual go right to a detention center? I mean, we sort of understand in the adult system, if you're arrested for a serious crime, you might have to go to jail until certain preliminaries are out of the way. Do detention centers work the same way, or does it work the same way for juveniles?
It's a little different for juveniles because juveniles don't have the right to bond. And so we're very cautious about which juveniles go into the detention centers across the state of North Carolina. We've actually decreased the population in our juvenile detention centers by 50% over the last 6 years. And we did that by putting in place a detention screening tool. And this tool really looks at whether or not that juvenile has a public safety threat to their neighbors and the people in their community, or do they have a threat to themselves, meaning that they may harm themselves before we could get them before a judge. Also in juvenile cases, they have to be seen before a judge within 3 days, and after they are held in a detention center, if the judge continues to hold them, they have to come back before that judge every 10 days to let the judge make a determination whether or not that juvenile needs to stay in a detention center or not. What we have found is that detention actually increases recidivism, not decreases it. So we try to reserve detention only for those kids that really truly scare us, or they scare us that they may harm themselves.
You mentioned recidivism. What is the recidivism rate for young offenders in North Carolina?
So in North Carolina, for kids that we divert from the system, and it's only about 20%, which is really good. But the deeper that they get into the system, the more likely they are to recidivate. So that's why we try really hard to divert kids from the system, if at all possible. By the time they get to the deeper end of the system, that can shoot up to almost 50% for kids that are in our deep end youth development centers, which is a committed facility that juveniles would stay in for almost a year.
You talked about the screening that goes on when a juvenile is at all referred to the system for whatever the incident was, the precipitating incident. And you just heard Rebecca Epstein from Georgetown Law Research talk about the adultification bias, particularly among, well, in her case, she looked at black girls. Can you tell how this plays out in North Carolina?
Yeah, we saw that bias about 10 years ago. We started looking at the data across the state of North Carolina. We're very fortunate that we have a system that all the intakes that come into the system for juvenile justice go into one system, so we can analyze that data and really look at what are the trends telling us. And about 10 years ago, we saw this spike going up among young females. And we really wanted to go back and look at our tools, the tools that we use to determine what happens with a juvenile next, and see if there was any bias built into those tools that was causing them to go deeper into the system. And so I can tell you the good news is that, first of all, juvenile crime across the state of North Carolina is down and is actually at a historic low. We're as low as we've been since we've been recording the data in the state of North Carolina. And that has precipitated for females also. We've seen almost a 44% decrease in the number of females that have been coming into the system. That does not mean we don't have a bias still towards African Americans in the system. They still make up 50% of the population that are in detention centers for our girls, and they're almost 70% of the females that are in our deep-end youth development centers for committed youth. And so we know there's still issues that are out there that we need to work on, and we try to address those tools to make sure that we're not including bias within those systems.
Well, I understand that one of the ways that you are addressing overrepresentation of African Americans is something called the School Justice Partnership. Can you tell us about that?
Absolutely. So what we find is that most juvenile complaints are filed on juveniles while they're at school. 43% of all juvenile complaints that came into the system last year were school-based offenses. For females, that's even higher. 50% of all juvenile complaints that came into the system last year were filed on that juvenile while they were at school. And let me just give you an example of the top three offenses. It's simple assault, which is a small fight where nobody got hurt. Simple affray, which is an even smaller fight. Normally, it could be just a pushing match. And then simple larceny, and those simple larceny would be for a very small amount of money that may have been stolen or a small item that was stolen. In the past, we wouldn't typically criminalize those issues. They were normally handled through school discipline. Today, we're finding that a lot of those incidents are actually filed into the juvenile justice system and criminalized. And so what we've done is we've set up school justice partnerships to work with law enforcement, our schools, our DAs, our judges across the state, to really think through what are those issues that are school discipline issues and what are those issues that are actually criminal justice issues. What are the kids that actually scare us because of the behaviors that are going on versus the kids that just kind of make us mad about something? And figuring out how do we want to handle those kids moving forward. We've seen a big reduction in the counties that have already started to put this in place. For example, in Durham County, we've seen almost a 50% reduction in their school-based offenses because they took a very focused approach to trying to address these school-based offenses and trying to keep those out of the criminal justice system moving forward.
Even with that screen that you've just applied, and clearly it's showing some results, but if you make a distinction between those things that scare us and those things that annoy us, it seems to me that your screening process, the one that you described early in this segment, when a juvenile makes contact with your system, seems to be looking at what are the root causes of this acting out behavior, and should we be addressing those as trauma or as something that needs our attention rather than needs detention?
Absolutely. And so we do a screening tool with each of those juveniles that come into the system. We do one that's called the Adverse Children Experiences, or the ACEs screening for trauma. For girls that came into our system last year, 89% of them screened in as having trauma as the reason that has driven them towards the system. And especially in our deeper end of the system, in our youth development centers last year, 100% of those kids that were in that system had been abused sexually by either someone in their house or someone in their community before they came into our system, so they have been victimized themselves. So the approach that we have taken in our facilities is very different. Several years ago, once we saw this trend occurring, we moved from just doing what was very much a punitive approach in juvenile justice 20 years ago to a much more therapeutic approach. And so the training that our staff goes through is trauma-informed CBT, which is cognitive behavior therapy. And those are the types of groups that we are doing now in our facilities with these young girls to really address that trauma that they face prior in their life.
In December of this year, the maximum juvenile age is going to change from 16 to 18. What effect do you think that'll have?
I think it's going to have a huge effect because what we're finding is that, especially with these younger African-American females, they're being brought into the system at 16 or 17 years old because they do look so much more adult-like, as your previous guest was talking about, or they're perceived as being more adult-like, and they get that first offense. And once you get into the system, it's hard to not have recidivization down the road because we find once you penetrate the system, you're much more likely to be on the radar of law enforcement and other people in the community to look out for more behaviors that you may have in the future. By keeping them out of the system early at 16 or 17 years old, we cut that out of the equation, but we also increase their hope. And what I mean by that is we don't put them down as having a criminal record because they got in a small fight at school. They can still go and go to college. They can still get employment. They can still get financial aid. Right now in the state of North Carolina, we were the last state to raise that age from 16 to 17, which meant that we were automatically disadvantaging our kids in our state from those same employment options or same school options that their counterparts in Virginia or South Carolina may have had. And so I think it's going to be a huge effect, number one, because it gives those kids hope that's not going to be a permanent stain on their record moving forward. And number two, we have the staff that are trained in our facilities and in our court counseling offices across the state to work with adolescents. That's what they do every single day. It's just like you wouldn't take your child to your normal doctor. You would take them to a pediatrician. We have trained staff to work with this age group, and we get better results. The research studies that have been done on this show that a 12.5% reduction in recidivism can be expected by just keeping those juveniles in the juvenile justice system.
William Lasseter, Deputy Secretary of Juvenile Justice at the North Carolina Department of Public Safety. William, thank you so much.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Well, joining the conversation now as we continue our conversation about the adult population now and take a look at that adult population as we switch from juveniles. Wanda Bertram is Communication Strategist for Prison Policy Initiative, and she joins me now. Wanda, welcome to the State of Things.
Thanks for having me.
We're talking about the number of incarcerated women and the growth in that population compared to men. What do you think is happening?
Right. Well, as you pointed out, you know, since 2016, women's prison populations in North Carolina have grown much more than men's percentage-wise. This matches what we've seen, for a longer period of time. The men's prison population in North Carolina is about three times larger than it was in the late 1970s, and that's already shocking. But then you look at the women's prison population, which is about five times larger than it was in the late 1970s. So these prison populations for women in North Carolina are continuing to grow faster than men's. And importantly, what we've seen is that about half of women incarcerated nationwide, and this holds true in North Carolina, half of them are not in prisons at all, but they're actually in county jails, either serving very short sentences for minor crimes or still awaiting trial, so they're still legally innocent.
So tell us the significance of that and what that tells us about our system.
Right. So nationwide, again, the reason, so we see about half of all incarcerated women being held in local jails. And this really matters, and it matters especially for women, because jails are not built for long stays. The fact that we have such a large large number of people in our justice system in general has meant that, you know, people wait longer for trial, and so people are spending a longer amount of time in county jails. They might wait weeks or months or even longer for a trial if they can't make bail or get out on bail. And why this matters for women is that while you are in jail, you do not have even the sparse resources that you would encounter in prison that could help you, start to turn your life around or rebuild your life. So women that are incarcerated, women that are charged with crimes, overwhelmingly come from backgrounds of trauma. They've got serious mental illnesses at higher rates than men. They have substance use problems at higher rates than men. Many of them have come from situations of sexual assault or domestic abuse. Many of them come from deep poverty. And when they end up in prison, and especially when they end up in jail, they are not getting the resources that they need to turn their lives around. And in particular, jails, which once again are built for these very short stays, are not providing things like substance use and mental health treatment.
And what are some of the unique challenges of female inmates who may be caregivers?
Right. Our research has shown that overwhelmingly, you know, women in jail are mothers. 80% of women in jail are mothers, and about 2/3 of women in jail are mothers of minor children, right? Children under 18. This is a big deal because, you know, if your mom goes to jail, you're without a caregiver, you know, until such time as she can either make bail or is released. That has torn families apart on a national level. And beyond actually physically removing mothers from their families, it has also imposed on families the costs of staying in touch with someone that's incarcerated. If you want to make a phone call to your child from jail, in a county jail, it can cost up to $1 a minute or more. Often visiting hours are very short. The consequences of separating women from their families are not just harsh for the women themselves. They also reverberate generationally, right? They impact whole families and whole communities.
What about you? What about the analysis that you've done on the statistics about incarcerated women in North Carolina? I'm interested to know whether that breaks down demographically, regionally, if you can see any differences and make any conclusions based on any of those distinctions.
So unfortunately, we weren't able to go deeper than the state level in our kind of national analysis of women's prison growth compared to men's. We were able to see that while, you know, there are some states where, you know, women's populations are falling, but they're not falling as fast as men's. North Carolina is one of the states where, you know, women's and men's populations are both rising and women's are rising faster. What we see from that and what we can kind of deduce from that is that there are specific things that the state could be doing to help fewer women end up in jail and prison. One of the things that it could do, you know, of course, is provide the resources that would, you know, allow women that are struggling to not end up in jail in the first place, right? By the time a woman with a serious mental illness or a substance use problem, you know, for instance, an opioid addiction, ends up in jail because she can't access treatment in her community, we've already failed her. So you know, counties, you know, hopefully using state funding, really need to provide more in the way of these services so that, you know, low income and marginalized women can access them. Furthermore, I think it's really important that counties change the way, change their policies around pretrial detention. It's most common in this country for people to be held in jail before trial on a money bail system, which means that if you can't put up the cash, you can't get out of jail before trial. You know, that not only increases the likelihood that if you're charged with a low-level crime, you're going to plead guilty, it also, just like you were talking about, separates women from their families from a longer period of time. Compared to men, women are less likely to be able to afford bail. And in a 2016 analysis that we did, we found that Black women are especially unable to afford bail. The average bail bond, which is, you know, close to $10,000, represents the annual income of a Black woman who's in the jail system and can't afford bail.
So you've got income inequalities for women, income inequalities for African Americans. When you put the two together, you're looking at a severe disadvantage. And of course, even in jail for 10, 20 or 30 days awaiting trial for a crime you may not have committed, you might lose your job.
Exactly. You know, being in jail pretrial, you know, puts people at risk of losing their jobs, losing their homes, losing their kids, all sorts of things.
One of the more interesting features of your report, I noticed that Louisiana and Mississippi were two states where the population of women in prison were falling. And you'll forgive me if I don't consider them in the vanguard of prison reform, Louisiana, Mississippi. What's going on there?
You know, that's a good question. And we, unfortunately, we don't know enough about Louisiana, Mississippi to actually tell. But we do know that, you know, in some of the states that are famous for being tough on crime, because as you pointed out, Louisiana and Mississippi both have some of the highest incarceration rates and the highest rates for women, you know, in the country. Some of the states that have been kind of the worst on this are the ones that are first beginning to recognize that some serious change is needed. So you know, those are the kinds of circumstances that might prompt a community to recognize, okay, it's time that we do something to stop sending women to jail just because they are low income or in need, or perhaps, you know, as I think New York City did, it's time to start encountering situations of women's domestic violence differently. So providing more resources to women experiencing sexual assault and domestic violence, and training police when they're called to a domestic violence incident, not to just assume that the woman was the aggressor, which frequently happens.
Wanda Bertram is communication strategist for the Prison Policy Initiative. Wanda, thanks so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
You can find links to their reporting and their work at our website, stateofthings.org. Just ahead, we're going to take a look at one way to address the number of incarcerated women, bail reform. We'll talk about it on the State of Things in just a moment. Stay with us. This is the State of Things. I'm Frank Stasio. I've been talking about incarcerated women today in North Carolina and nationwide. The number of women in state prisons is growing faster than the number of men. Data from the Prison Policy Initiative show that nearly half of women behind bars in the U.S. are in local jails, and 60% of them have not been convicted of a crime. Bail reform may be one way to lower the number of women in jail. Jessica Smith is a professor at the UNC School of Government. She has researched the issue and works with local jurisdictions across the state on alternatives to jail. Jesse, welcome. Good to have you here. Tell us about some of the problems that you have encountered, or as you see it and go around the state. How would you characterize our bail system and the way it's working?
Sure. I'd like to actually take a minute to lay a little bit of groundwork before I answer that specific question. And your guest immediately before us touched on some of the issues in the bail system. But for your listeners, I think it's important for folks to understand that when we're talking about bail, the bail system, we're talking about the part of the system that applies after an arrest and before a person goes to trial. And when they go to trial, they're entitled to a presumption of innocence. And the way it works in North Carolina is that when someone's arrested, they get brought before a judicial official for what we call conditions. And there are five types of conditions that can be imposed. One of those is a secured bond, sometimes called a money bond. And that is actually, although we have five different conditions, by far the most common condition that's imposed. About 72% of defendants who get conditions get a secured bond. And the key thing about the secured bond, as has been alluded to in your conversation that you just had, is it requires money to get out of jail. So if you, Frank, get arrested on a DWI and you get a impaired driving conviction, and you get a $2,500 bond, you probably have $2,500 in your bank account that you can put up for it. But if the person who gets arrested maybe works at Taco Bell or somewhere like that, they may not have the money. They're going to have to go out to the private bail bonds industry to get a bondsman, for example, and they're going to pay a fee for the bondsman to secure the bond. But either way, the secured bond, the money bond, as its name suggests, requires money to get out of jail. And that's the background to begin to understand what the problems are that people are seeing in the system. And basically, they fall into three broad categories, three categories of issues that people are worried about with respect to the system. One, that it undermines public safety. Two, that it inefficiently uses taxpayer resources. And three, that it undermines the fairness of the criminal justice system.
You want to take them one at a time? Public safety, how does
it
do that?
Sure. It undermines public safety, as the argument goes, in three primary ways. First, it allows really dangerous but wealthy people to bond out of jail. So Don, the drug trafficker, who's involved in all kinds of violent crimes and drug trafficking, gets arrested. And he's a dangerous guy. He's at the head of the organization. And the judge puts $1 million bond on him. But he's a drug trafficker, so he's got some resources. So he can either put the money down himself, pay a bondsman, and he gets to walk out of jail. The bond didn't protect the public. This dangerous dude gets to walk out of jail. And importantly, the bond isn't forfeited if he resumes his drug trafficking activities, or if he threatens or kills the witnesses so he can't be brought to trial. The bond's only forfeited if he fails to show up in court. So the bond doesn't protect the public in those instances when we're talking about really dangerous people with money.
All right. And I want to stop you just right there just for a moment. Again, Don the drug dealer could be out on bail, kill a few witnesses, show up for trial, get his $1 million back, and he gets all $1 million back. If I, who work at Taco Bell, have a $2,500 bond and don't have that, I pay for that. My fee is law. If I show up for the court, right, the bond is returned to the bondsman, but is my fee returned to me?
You raise a really good point. It's if you show up in court, your charges are acquitted or your charges are dismissed, you never see the money back that you pay to the bondsman. It's a wealth transfer from an individual in communities through to private industry. So we talked about under supervision of dangerous people as a public safety issue. Another issue is that because money is the ticket out, there are a lot of people who aren't risky, but they just don't have the money, who end up detained pretrial. And what we've discovered is that there's research that shows when you detain low-level defendants pretrial, you're actually creating more crime. There's a big study out of Harris County, Texas, third largest county in the U.S., almost 400,000 defendants, looked at misdemeanor defendants. And those who were detained pretrial compared to basically similar cohorts, those who were detained, although they didn't commit crimes while they were detained, they were in jail, 18 months post-hearing once they were out, 30% increase in felonies and 20% increase in misdemeanors. So, you know, sometimes people think tough on crime, let's lock everyone up, without realizing that sometimes when you lock up these low-level defendants, you're actually undermining your fundamental public safety
goals. They're losing their jobs. It's hard for them to get another job. What's left to them but to return to or perhaps enter a criminal system that they weren't because they may have been acquitted?
That's right.
So, okay. So that's so now we're looking at both sides of the public safety question. Then, of course, there's the cost we're having to pay to keep people in jail, right?
Yes. And we're paying a lot of money. The scope of detention, as was suggested in your earlier segment, is vast. It's also expensive. We detain about 500,000 people a day. Cost, conservative estimate, is $14 billion. Oh. Now, if that money was being used to detain the most dangerous people, Don the drug trafficker or the serial rapist and people like that, people would say, well, money well spent. But the evidence suggests that's not happening. There's research that shows we're detaining significant percentages of really low-level defendants. That Harris County study that I just mentioned found that almost half of misdemeanor defendants, those are lower-level crimes, are detained pretrial. And there's similar results from other jurisdictions. And that research suggests that we may be spending enormous sums of money detaining the wrong people.
So what are some alternatives that you've explored that are being explored perhaps across this state?
Well, one alternative when you're talking about detention is release. And there can be just simply release on a written promise to appear for certain very low-risk people. But there also can be supervised release. And so that's one thing that communities are looking at. And that's typically done through something called a pretrial services program. So whether the person's wealthy and bonds out or they're stuck because they can't afford their bond, offering a pretrial services program is another form of release that's allowed in North Carolina that can be scaled dependent upon what kind of support and services that the defendant needs pretrial, as well as supervision. So pretrial services programs can provide things like transportation vouchers and court date reminders and referrals to mental health and substance use counseling that was mentioned in your earlier segment. They also can provide supervision to make sure that people aren't engaging in negative behaviors when they're out. But the broader question of how we solve the issue of our bail system is at once easy and really, really hard. And it's easy because there are some low-hanging fruit, no-brainer kind of things that jurisdictions across North Carolina can do with relatively little resources. Things like offering prompt judicial review of bail conditions. That doesn't happen everywhere. In some places in North Carolina, defendants charged with misdemeanors who are detained on money bonds pretrial may not get before a judge for weeks. Affording those people prompt judicial review of their conditions is an opportunity for their lawyer to advocate on their behalf that they don't need to be in jail and that the bond is too high and that they should be released. That's an example of the kind of no-brainer type solutions that jurisdictions are looking at and are actually implementing, and there are others that we could talk about. But when you get to the question of how do you figure out who's really risky, who presents the real pretrial risk, and what's the level of services and supervision that we we should provide them. That's where things get hard. And it gets hard because the research is kind of in its infancy in this area. And what we really need to do is spend some more time looking at innovations that jurisdictions are doing and doing the rigorous empirical evaluation to figure out how do we determine which defendants can just be released outright, which defendants need supervision. And for those that need supervision, what type of supervision would work for them, and which defendants are really just too dangerous to be released.
Screening for safety is one thing, but providing services under supervised release, if you think about that, it's kind of a market-based approach. What you're saying really is we're not meeting the mental health needs of our population, and they're ending up in prison, and we all know that. And because we're criminalizing mental health problems for people who are poor, if we actually forced ourselves to provide the services they need, we would find out precisely what it costs and what people need to reduce the crime rate and the cost of crime in this country. But you'd have to actually commit to finding those people, and that would be a system where you would commit to services rather than incarceration.
Well, I mean, the criminal justice system, unfortunately, has to deal with a lot of social problems. And there are a number of people with mental health and substance use issues that come into the system. And in fact, another strategy that jurisdictions I'm working with are looking at are pre-charge diversion, meaning instead of charging that person with a crime, if they have a substance use or mental health issue, divert them to appropriate services through the Stepping Up program, the LEAD program. There are a whole variety of programs that jurisdictions are implementing and expanding in North Carolina.
Well, joining the conversation now is an activist working on bail reform in North Carolina. Kyla Hartsfield is the North Carolina state organizer for Southerners on New Ground, a regional queer liberation organization, and she joins us now. Hello, Kyla.
Hi, how's it going?
It's going very well. What are some of the ways that you've been advocating for bail reform?
Well, we launched a regional demand to end money bail about 2 years ago in Durham. We have been on the campaign for the last 2 years and in the need to launch this campaign. Our co-director, Mary Hooks, came up with the idea to bail out Black women for Mother's Day to use as a tactic to bring light to the money bail system. And I also see it as a way of, like, we're asking to end money bail. We're asking to end pretrial incarceration, and we're not getting that. And we're like, we're just going to do it. And we're just going to go to the jails and bail out Black moms for Mother's Day. And we just had a bailout, our fourth bailout, last week.
Well, tell us more about that strategy and whether or not that's going to be an ongoing strategy or that was just a kind of a one-off that's been repeated a couple times.
Well, we hope it's not an ongoing strategy because we really hope that money bail is ended. But the strategy, we believe that Black women hold up their communities and that the communities are hurting when they don't have Black women. And we decided to just basically return them back to community as well as offering services because we know, like many people that we have bailed out, have drug addiction problems and mental health services. So trying to connect them and are homeless and trying to connect them to those services and being responsible and not just bailing them out and being like, you know, you're good, but connecting them to services.
The city of Durham, or I guess Durham County would be more appropriate here, came up with new pretrial release policy, and you were not happy with that.
We were not happy about it. I think we expected, well, like history of the campaign is that we have petition as partners to sign the petition to end money bail. We have surveyed people at the courthouse in the jail to ask them what they need to get back to court, which includes text reminders, call reminders, transportation, childcare. There's no childcare in the courthouse and you can't bring kids with you. We've also met with Judge Hudson. We've met with DA Dewberry. We've met with Sheriff Burkhead multiple times. We've had Team of the Willing dinners, which is dinners that we hold with our coalitional partners who are also working on bail reform to map out where everyone is. And we felt like the policy would give more after all this work of 2 years, and it still included a bond schedule and included a risk assessment. It criminalizes drug addiction, specifically methamphetamine, and it criminalizes mental health. And
well, it used the phrase, I think, sound mind, in quotes, which was what a judge could use to set bail and to determine risk, and that seemed like a one of the points of contention here.
Yeah, we asked Judge Hudson what that mean and never really got a clear answer of what sound mind meant and what is the prerequisites to see if someone has a sound mind. But yeah, we don't like it. We had a press conference. We told Durham to do better because we know Durham can do better. We see ourselves as a progressive city, and we know the community was also asking for way more than the policy we received.
What are some of the alternatives you think could replace money bail, money bond?
I'm thinking like what Jesse Smith was saying with a written promise to release, and we are really pushing for a needs assessment to be pushed. So like asking people what they need to get back to jail, and also what you said about like committing to services, because we see the jails being used as a homeless shelter, is being used as a mental health services, and it's being used as drug addiction services, when we could divest from prisons and invest in those services and people would be able to get them outside of a cage.
Jesse Smith, tell me what's happening. How much discretion is at the county level, at the district level, and how much is at the state level? Where do these policies have to change, I guess is my question.
Well, there's several tiers to it. Of course, there's the Constitution at the top, which sets some parameters on how you can take people's liberty, which is what happens when you incarcerate them. Mm-hmm. There are state statutes. And actually, our state statutes, in some respects, are not that bad. If you look at them, there are some provisions that are a little problematic. They're not evidence-based, and they would require detentions in certain situations. But as a general matter, the statutes have a very clear preference for non-financial conditions and resorting to a secured bond only where the defendant is, for example, a flight risk or a risk of some committing some crime while out on pretrial release or intimidating witnesses or otherwise undermining the justice system. Then what happens at the local level is the statutes afford the senior resident superior court judge require the senior resident superior court judge to issue local pretrial release policies. And so every senior resident in North Carolina can adopt their own pretrial policies. And those policies can vary significantly from jurisdiction to jurisdiction. I've looked at a lot of them. There are a lot of similarities. But one of the things that happens is that a lot of how the local procedure operates depends on the resources that they have. For example, Mecklenburg County has been on the forefront of bail reform for many years, but Mecklenburg has a lot of resources. They have county-funded pretrial services people who can supervise and provide support services. Other communities that are rural and poor have far less resources, and they have to work with what they have to make the best
decisions.
So that
may be where the state gets involved to try to equalize some of that if there were a policy, a blanket policy provision that was going to take place.
It is a financial issue, though, that largely impacts local governments. The jails are funded at the county level, not the state level.
Jessica Smith is a professor in the School of Government at UNC Chapel Hill. Jesse, thank you so much.
Sure. Thanks for having me.
Kyla Hartsfield is North Carolina State Organizer for Southerners on the Ground. Thank you, Kyla.
Thank you.
You can find links to their work at our website, stateofthings.org. Our program is produced by Anita Rao, Laura Pelliser, Dana Terry, Amanda Magnus, and Jennifer Brooklyn. Robin Copley is our technical director. Jenny Lawson's on the board today with help from Al Wadarski. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.